The plan for today is to finish talking about the tangent space. Then we'll talk about the cotangent space. And about tensors. This time I think we might be able to do all of what I'm planning. So last time, the last thing we talked about was defining the tangent space to a manifold in terms of derivations. And we saw that there was a basis for TAM. Once we have a chart U phi, where phi can be seen as a collection of scalar maps. So if we do this, the basis is given by these things here, which map functions to this. So we have functions that are smooth functions between the manifold and R, and we apply this operator on them by looking at the coordinate representation of the function, taking the derivative, which we can do because now it's a function from Rn to Rm, or to R, really, and then evaluate it at the coordinate representation of the point. So that's our definition. The thing that's left to say is, how do we relate the basis for one chart to the basis for a different chart? Because I chose a specific chart, I could have chosen a different one. So let V psi, with psi, this time we're going to call the coordinates y1 to yn, be another chart. And it still needs to cover our point, so A must be in V. So we can just as well define D over dy I at A. Acting on a function f, this is going to give us df at, I'm going to be explicit now because we have two different charts. So instead of writing f at, I'm going to write explicitly the coordinate representation, which is f composed with psi to the minus 1. Over d yi. And I'm going to evaluate this at psi of a. We want to relate this to the action that this one has so we can connect the two bases. There should be some kind of linear map that sends one into the other. Now, first of all, to make things less ambiguous, I'm going to use a different notation here. I'm going to call this di of f composed psi to the minus 1 up psi of a. So what I'm doing here is instead of using the partial derivative notation, which is ambiguous because y is some kind of variable, but variables can be renamed. So when we call this y, we have a meaning for it. It can be confusing. This just means the derivative with respect to the ith argument, whatever that is. We don't need to give it a name. The trick now is that we can write f composed psi to the minus 1 in this way. So this is di of f composed phi to the minus 1 composed psi composed, phi composed psi to the minus 1. So I'm just putting in an identity here because phi to the minus 1 composed phi is the identity. This restricts the function because now I can only work on the overlap between psi and phi, but this is a derivative. It only cares about the actual point and a little bit around it. So we can always restrict it a bit. And we evaluate still up psi of a. And at this point, because this is actually a function that goes from some subset over n to R, we just use the usual stuff we know about derivatives. And in particular, this function and these functions are also nice functions between Rn and Rn for this case, Rn and R for this case. So I can use the chain rule on this derivative. So now we need to take the derivative with respect to the jth argument of this one. And this is going to be evaluated at, we need to apply this to this to this. So psi to the minus 1 cancels psi. So this is at phi of a. And then we need to multiply by the jth component of the derivative of this thing with respect to y. So we have the derivative of phi composed psi to the minus 1, jth component at psi of a. So this was just the usual chain rule from calculus. Everything still clear to this point? Okay, now two things to note. This thing is the same as d over dx j at a acting on f. That's how we defined it here. That's the partial derivative respect to the ith argument. In our case, I switch it to j of the coordinate representation of f in the phi coordinate chart, which is exactly what this is. So we have this, which multiplies this thing. And this thing, I'm just going to call it capital J, Ji. This is just a Jacobian matrix. Of the transition function. This is the transition function between the chart phi and psi. And this is the derivative with respect to the ith argument of the jth component of this thing. So this is the ij entry of a matrix. And that's the Jacobian matrix. This function here is invertible. It's smooth. Its inverse is also smooth. And in terms of the Jacobian, it just tells us that the Jacobian is a nice invertible matrix. So this thing equals d over dyi acting on f. So this is telling us that the way we go from one basis to the other is by multiplying by the Jacobian matrix. Because this is true for every possible function. So d over dyi at a is going to be, if you want to write it again explicitly, it's di. Now, this, the j component of this thing is the same as acting with the jth component of phi on this. So I can write it as xj composed psi to the minus 1, evaluated at psi of a, times d over dxj. So this is how you go from one basis to the next when you change coordinates. Right now, it looks kind of ugly. To make this look much simpler and also much easier to remember, we're going to do something which is a bit of an abuse of notation. Right now, the problem is that these functions act on the manifold. So if you want them to act on real numbers, we need to compose them with psi to the minus 1. But it's very annoying to do. So the common abuse of notation that we employ is the following. we're going to think of xi as a function of the coordinates y. So even though xi technically applies on the manifold, we're going to just identify xi composed with psi to the minus 1 with xi itself. So this really will be xi composed psi to the minus 1 of y. The reason why we do this is that then we can rewrite this more simply as d over dyi at a is dxj over dyi evaluated at psi of a d over dxj. So this is not technically correct, but it's a lot simpler to do and to remember than this, although they are the same thing. So this is one of the other reasons why we use this notation for the basis vectors, is that it's easy to remember how they transform, because you just use the chain rule, pretty much. So it's like you're multiplying and dividing by xi, you need to sum over things. Okay, so this is the formula. I'm going to show you an example that with actual charts, so that it's going to be clear why exactly we're doing this thing, and now it relates to things that people commonly do. Before we move on to the example, is this clear? I guess there's one thing to add. The way you usually see the transformation law for vectors, it's the opposite of this. Usually when you think of vectors, they transform with the other Jacobian, the one that has y on top and x at the bottom. The reason why is that we're transforming the basis vectors, not the components. If I write a vector as v is vi d over dxi at a, if this transforms one way, this transforms the opposite way, because you're multiplying them. So if you think of matrices, this one is transformed with the inverse of the one that you have for this. Okay, so let's see an example. The example that I'm going to do is the cylinder. The cylinder can be thought of as the set of all points in x, y, z, such that x squared plus y squared is 1. I'm choosing one specific cylinder, an infinite cylinder that's vertical. I guess this will be we can make it into a manifold by using some charts. This is actually a nice example because it has only one chart. You can do this with only one chart. So the first chart that we're going to use is the whole set C itself. And then I'm going to use this chart. I'm going to give it directly the components thing. So this is one vector map that's really two scalar maps. I'm going to call this coordinates S and T. And they are defined like this, S of V, where V is something in here. Actually, to avoid confusion, even though it doesn't technically matter because they're dummy variables, I'm going to write this as V1, V2, V3. The reason why it's going to be clear soon, there's a big problem with coordinates, and that is that they have names. And if you use the same name for something else, then you're going to get confused very soon. So just to avoid any confusion, I'm not going to use x, y, and z as points in the manifold, because those are the name of the coordinates, and then we just get very confused. So the coordinate s of one of the vectors is going to be e to the v3 times v1, and s of t of v is going to be e to the v3, v2. This thing is going to map the whole cylinder to, so the image of this thing, let's just call this phi. The image of phi, so phi of c, is going to be the whole of R2 minus the origin, which is an open set in R2, as we expect, because the chart needs to map to an open set. You can see what's happening. V1 and V2 are in a circle. But then by multiplying by the exponential of V3, I can make this circle as small as I want. So I can make these points lie on any circle I want. So eventually, you can get the whole of R2 other than the 0, 0 point, which you can never reach. Because this exponential is always positive, and V1 squared plus V2 squared is always going to be 1. There's only one chart, so you actually don't need to check anything. It's automatically going to have a smooth transition function with itself, because it's the identity. And really, the only thing to check is that this thing is open, which it is. Okay, and in addition to this, I'm going to give you one other chart so we can do the change of coordinates. The next chart is going to be a subset U. So I'm going to call this U psi. Now, U is going to be the cylinder, but then I'm going to remove something. I'm going to remove the set of all things that look like this. I'm removing a whole vertical line from the cylinder. The reason why it's going to be clear once I tell you what the coordinate chart is, the map psi is going to be divided into things. I'm going to give us coordinate theta and z. Now you can imagine what I'm trying to do here. I'm calling the z coordinate z because it's going to be the height on the z axis of the point. And theta is going to be the coordinate, the angle coordinate in the xy plane. So I'm essentially giving cylindrical coordinates to the cylinder, which is a very sensible thing to do. And the reason why I removed this minus 1 point for the whole line is that that's why you have problems with the angle, because you wrap around. So you need to remove something. We want to, just because it's the convention, we want to make our angle go from minus pi to pi, but at these points, the angle will switch between minus pi and pi, so you will get something discontinuous, and we don't like that. So to be more specific, theta of v is going to be this function. You get a tan 2 of v2, v1. Is everyone familiar with the a tan 2 function? OK, I see some no's. We don't need to really see what it is. There's a definition. You can look it up. It's a way of piecing up the arctangent, which is not defined everywhere, in such a way that you can match up different quadrants. So this is going to give you the angle between the vector v1 and v2. If you look at the plane, you have some vector here with coordinates v1, v2. The angle between the x-axis and this vector is going to be a tan 2 of v2, v1. It's a piecewise defined function. It takes a bit of time to define it, but it's smooth everywhere other than where it has the problem of jumping between one angle and the other. And also, it's such that this belongs to minus pi to pi. So it gives you the angle between two things, but because angles are defined only up to 2 pi, you need to design which interval they're in. You could choose 0 to 2 pi, but for convention, we usually do minus pi to pi, just so it's symmetric around 0. The actual a tan 2 function includes minus pi as a point. We're excluding it by removing that line from our circle, so this is an open set. Otherwise, the image of the chart will not be open. And then z of v is simple. This is just going to be v3. And this can be anything in R. So the actual image of the map psi is going to be R times this interval, which is an open set, so everything is fine. And we're not going to do this because it's not the point of this example, but if you check the transition maps between this chart and this chart, it's going to work out fine, so they are part of the same atlas. Okay, so what I want to show you as an example is how to change from this chart to that chart, and how to transform the vector d over ds at some point v naught in terms of the basis d over d theta, d over dz. And same for the other one. So it's going to be something times d over d theta at v naught plus something else d over dz at v naught. It's a 2x2 matrix, so we can just write it directly this way. Same thing for d over d theta, as d over dt. It's going to be some linear combination of the other two. The formula, we know it, is the one written on the other board. And the real reason why I want to show this example is that I'm going to make it clear why we use the Abelson notation over there. One thing we can do is interpret s and t as functions of theta and z directly. So to do this, we put together this information. So s of v equals this, theta of v equals that. But you can invert these things. If theta of v equals this, then v1 equals cosine of theta, and v2 is sine of theta. We are choosing the eta and 2 function because it's the angle between the x-axis and the point, and we know that if I have the angle, I can get this point as, because it's on the circle of radius 1, it's just going to be cosine of the angle and sine of the angle for the y coordinate. And by inverting this, v3 is just z. So these are really the components of psi to the minus 1. So technically, whenever I do things like in here, I need to compose s and t with psi to the minus 1 and write that all the time. But the Abelson notation just tells us you can just say, OK, so s of theta z is going to be. Because we know that s is going to be e to the v3 times v1, but v3 is z, v1 is the cosine of theta, you can write this as e to the z cosine of theta. And t of theta z is e to the z sine of theta. By doing this, to look at the Jacobian matrix, we just need to look at the derivatives, ds over dz, which is just s itself, and then ds over d theta, which ends up being minus t. And similarly, dt over dz is t itself. Dt over d theta is going to be just s. And then those things you can write in terms of the actual point, because we know s and t and how they look like. So putting all of this together, here when I wrote there's something here, that something, we know what it is. This is the theta over, well, I guess I should have done the inverse thing. Let's do the other thing, just because otherwise I have to invert these functions. Instead of doing this, let's do the other transformation. So we'll do d over d theta in terms of s and t. So this is the s over d theta evaluated at, it's going to be evaluated at psi of our point. So it would be really theta of, if this is our point, I call it v naught, I think. So theta of v naught, and then z of v naught. This is times d over ds of d naught plus dt over d theta, theta of 0, z 0 d over dt of d naught. And these things we can just get from there. So this is going to just be ds over d theta is just the same as minus t. But minus t is just minus e to the v3 times v2. So this is minus e to the v3 times v2, which multiplies t over dt at v0. And these ones are really the components of v0. So you should think of v0 as being v1, v2, v3. And then for the next one, dt over d theta is just s. S was e to the v3 times v1 plus e to the v3 times v1 d over ds. Sorry. This one was over ds and this one is over t. So eventually, this is how you will do the calculation. Would have been the same if you didn't use the Abelson notation. It's just easier to think about things because now you can just write a formula like this and then it's easy to take the derivatives. Otherwise, you need to always think of composing with the inverse and it just gets ugly to write out. Okay, so this is everything about tangent vectors. Are there any questions before we move on to other things? So now we have vectors. The next thing we want to do is talk about covectors. Are you all familiar with the concept of a dual space? OK, seems like you are. So I'm going to just review the important things that we need, but I'm not going to spend time proving things about it. But if you're not familiar with the things I'm writing, please ask me and stop me so that I can actually tell you. So we're going to need to talk about dual spaces. So let V be a real vector space. And to make things simple, we'll also assume it's finite dimensional. Then by definition, the dual of V is the thing we call V star, which is the set of all maps that go from V to R, which are linear. So this is called the dual vector space to R. It's a set of linear maps. And it turns out that just because of the fact that linear maps are specified by the action on a basis. This is always true for any linear maps. They don't have to be going to R. That's why you usually write linear maps as matrices. If I tell you what a matrix does on a basis, that's all I need to know about a linear map. So this ends up telling us that these things are actually fully specified if the dimension of V is n by n numbers, which is the action of alpha on each of the basis elements. And if they have different actions, they're going to be different maps. So it's not difficult to put all of this together and show that V and V star are isomorphic. They have the same dimension. The problem about this isomorphism, though, is this is not a canonical isomorphism. By which I mean, unless we have extra information about the space, such as a metric, for example, we don't have a way to actually construct this isomorphism in a natural way. There isn't an obvious way to connect those. To actually do the connection, we need to choose a basis. By choose a basis, I mean that we take some basis elements I'm going to call ei, go from 1 to n in our original space V. Then I can define another basis in V star starting from these bases. This is called the dual basis. So these ones are going to be what we call an epsilon j. I'm going to put the indices down for the vectors, up for the basis of the covectors. Now, this seems like the opposite of what you're used to, but remember that usually you talk about components. So components of vectors have the indices up, but vectors themselves and the indices down, if you want to choose a basis. Same thing for the covectors. So the dual basis is a collection of linear maps in V star. So each epsilon j goes from V to R. And because I only need to say what happens on a basis to define the action of epsilon, I'm going to say that epsilon j acting on ei is delta ji. That's how we define the basis. And then the isomorphism is simply mapping ei to epsilon I. Once we have two bases, we can just map one into the other and then extend everything else by linearity, and we have an isomorphism. But to do this, I need to choose a basis. If you don't choose a basis, there is no other way of choosing a covector given a vector. Let me assure that there's nothing else I need to tell you about covectors. No, that's everything. Is this clear? Are there any questions? Okay, so now that we know what the dual of a vector space is, we can define the cotangent space. So given a manifold M and a point A, the cotangent space at the point A in M is very easy. We call it T star AM, and this is simply TAM star. We already know how to do the vector space, tensors come later, the tangent space of vectors tangent at the point. We just take the dual of that, and we call those things covectors, and the space where they leave the cotangent space. So there's really nothing deep about this. It's defined as a set of linear maps on the tangent space. It will turn out to be extremely useful, though, as we'll see next week when we talk about differential forms. But for now, these are just covectors, and really they are nothing special at this point other than being duals of vectors. And just as the tangent space, we can give a basis to the cotangent space once we choose coordinates. Using the same procedure that we did in general for the dual space. So if I have a chart U, phi, where phi has coordinates x1, xn at our point, then I define a new basis and I give it this weird name, dxi, with the subscript a to remember where the point we are at, I equal 1 to n. This will be a basis. And the way I define it is that this is really the dual basis. Of d over dxi dot a. So for these ones, the reason why we use this notation hopefully is clear, because we just define them as derivations, so it actually looks pretty normal. For these ones at this point, there isn't a reason. It will turn up once we talk about differential forms that this makes perfect sense. But for now, it's just some notation. So this is just a name for the dual of this thing. So just as a reminder, this means that dxia is a map that goes from tam to r, and is defined on the basis like this. If I act with the dxi map on d over dxj, then I get delta ij out of this. So if they have the same index, you get 1, otherwise you get 0. There's really all there is to this. And if we want to look at the way they transform, we just need to look at the way this one transforms and use that information to figure out the dxi. So I'm not going to go through all the steps because it's really the same thing, but dy, if I have now another set of coordinates, dy at a, using the Abelian notation, because of this fact and the fact that this thing transforms into the Jacobian matrix, if you go into all the steps, you can see that you get the inverse Jacobian matrix for this. So it will be dy over dxj. This time, this is going to be evaluated at psi of a, or phi of a, because we are changing from the other coordinates. And then we have dxj evaluated at a. This is not a difficult thing to do. It's just something that's always true about dual bases. If one basis transforms with one matrix, the dual basis transforms with the inverse matrix. So if you want to, you can just check this yourself. So at least one reason why we choose this notation is that, again, it makes it clear what the formula should be just by using the chain rule. So if you just think calculus, the differential of y should be dy over dx times dxj. Now, in calculus, you've probably been taught by some overzealous calculus teacher that this is illegal. This doesn't make sense. These things are not actual numbers, which is true. But this is differential geometry, and these things are actually perfectly well-defined objects. So even though this formula looks like something that you're not supposed to write, even though you write it for convenience, in differential geometry, this is an object. This is a linear map. It just has a name. This is a linear map, it has a name. The connection between the two is this matrix. There's really nothing bad about writing this down. That's everything about the cotangent space. This one was easy. There's not much to say, just the dual of the other one. Any questions? OK, then let's just move on to the next thing, which is tensors. Tensors are a bit more complicated. And the reason why lies in the thing that I'm about to tell you now. The idea of tensors is that they should generalize both vectors and covectors. But right now, vectors and covectors are very different objects. Vectors are, well, they're just vectors, they live in some place. But covectors are linear maps. They are some weird kind of vectors. So ideally, we would like to make them look the same so that we can then generalize both of them in some way. We don't have a way to easily make covectors look like vectors, but we can make vectors look like covectors. So what we're going to do is look at the dual of a dual. So if you look at V star star, this is isomorphic to V. Simply because we just saw that the dual is isomorphic to the original space. If you take the dual again, it's still isomorphic to the original space. This isomorphism, though, is different than the one I told you about before. When I told you about this is not a natural or canonical isomorphism. I cannot just tell you right away without introducing a basis what the isomorphism is. For this one, I can. This is a natural isomorphism. The isomorphism works like this. I have a map that takes a vector in V and associates to it phi V, which is a covector in V star star. So this is really a, it's in here, but V star star is a set of all linear maps that go from V star to R. So I can take a vector and associate to it a linear map on V star. And this can be done in a natural way by doing this. Phi of V acting on a linear map alpha, which is an element of V star. So this is in V star, is going to be alpha acting on V. So the reason why I can naturally do this without choosing a basis is that I want V to act on alpha. But alpha is already something that acts on vectors. So the easiest thing is that V acts on alpha by feeding itself to alpha. You can check that this is indeed an isomorphism. It's linear because alpha itself is linear. So if I have the sum of two vectors, you can split up the sum here and everything works. And as well, you can check by seeing what happens to the basis that different basis elements are sent to different things, or that if you want zero, it's only sent to zero. So you can check also this is injective, and it's indeed an isomorphism. The importance of this thing we just done is that now covectors are maps acting on vectors, and vectors can be thought of as maps acting on covectors. So now they are on the same footing. They're both maps acting on something else, which is what gives us the idea of making tensors, things that act on both vectors and covectors, and as many as we want of them. Right now we have vectors act on a single covector. Covectors act on a single vector. Why not act on more than one vector or more than one covector? So that's how we'll define tensors. Okay, so by definition, a tensor of type RS is a multilinear map I'll explain what multilinear means in a moment. This is going to be T that acts on, like I said, a tensor on some vector space V is going to be a map that goes from, which order do I use? There are different conventions, so I want to make sure they're consistent. So we start with V star. So it acts on V star times V star, and this is going to be R copies of it, and R can be zero as well, so we could not have any of the stars, times V, times V, times V. This one is S copies to R. Now, multilinear means that this map is linear in each one of these arguments. So if you fix all of the other arguments and you look at the first one, if you feed it a linear combination, the linear combination goes outside of the map. And if you do it for the second one, same thing. Third one, same thing. You've probably seen things like this already. Well, you've seen tensors already, so it's not like they're crazy. But bilinear maps is something that happens quite often. You feed it to vectors, and it should be linear both in the first one and the second one. This is an extension of that with as many arguments as you want, R plus S. The reason why it generalizes both things is that if you look at the case in which R is 1 and S is 0, so R equal 1, S equal 0, we get maps that go from V star to R, and those can be identified with vectors. So they're not exactly vectors, or at least they are technically distinct, but they're isomorphic in a natural way, so we can always identify them. And S equal 1, R equal 0, these ones will be covectors. This one are exactly covectors, because they are maps going from V to R, they're linear. And then you have all sorts of other things. You could choose R equal 1, S equal 1. But maybe as an example, it's going to be easier if we do S equal 2, R equal 0. This will just be some bilinear map. So for example, a scalar product. Or a metric tensor. So it's something that you feed it to vectors and it spits out one number. So the simplest example that you can think of is just a scalar product, like in Rn. You have two vectors, you end up with one number in a linear way. And then you can have all kinds of combinations of these things. Does the definition make sense? Is this what you had seen already for tensors or not? Yes?
Is it defined at a point on a manifold or?
Right now, we don't have manifolds yet. So this definition actually applies to a vector space. I didn't define the tensor space to a manifold yet. That's the next thing we're going to do. So right now, I have some vector space, which will be any kind of vector space you want. The only restriction that we have is that it should be finite dimensional. It actually doesn't have to. But if it's infinite dimensional, the notion of a dual is a bit icky. There are two notions of duals. And then to avoid confusion, we just make it finite dimensional. So just some vector space, and then you can define multilinear maps on the vector space. You call them tensors. The next step will be to attach these to a manifold. And at this point, we're only doing things point-wise. Next week, we're going to start talking about fields and how to smoothly move from one point to the other and have a tensor field instead of just a tensor. Yes?
How does this definition compare with like taking tensor products of vector spaces and dual vector spaces?
Good question. It's the same thing. It's going to be clear in a moment. I'm going to tell you what the tensor product is.
Yeah.
And you'll see that taking tensor products is the same as doing this thing. So that's one other way of defining tensor, is just it's the tensor product. But we still need the notion of multilinear map in any case to talk about tensor products. OK, so tensor products. They are a useful thing because they're going to allow us to find the basis for the tensor space. So tensor products look like this. So by definition, if V and W are real finite dimensional vector spaces, and then we have alpha, which is a linear map from V to R, beta is a linear map from W to R. Then we can talk about the tensor product of alpha and beta. The tensor product of alpha and beta is the bilinear map alpha times beta. So this is the usual notation. So this is going to work like this. To a pair V W in V times W is going to associate alpha times alpha of V times beta of V, beta of W. So just alpha acts on the first one, beta acts on the second one, and multiply them together. You can check it's linear because alpha itself is linear and beta itself is linear. So this you can do for any kind of vector spaces and any maps between vector spaces. In our case, we're always going to have alpha goes from V, beta goes from W, from W is going to be V star, essentially, or another copy of V itself. Okay, so to use this, first of all, we should note something I didn't tell you yet. If we put all of the tensors of a given type together, we get another vector space. So I'm going to define this thing, TRS of V is going to be the set of all tensors of type RS. And this thing itself is a vector space. It's a vector space with pointwise operation. It's the usual way we give a vector space to a set of maps that goes to R. Because they're maps that go to R, we can always take the vector space on R structure and then pointwise we add it. So technically what we do is that alpha T plus beta s evaluated at all of the arguments that are going to be r vectors, r covectors, and s vectors. This is the same as doing alpha times t evaluated at this plus beta s evaluated at all this. The usual contract, we've probably done this 6 to 7 times at this point, so it should be clear. And if you do this, this is a vector space. So we can make tensors themselves into vectors, which of course means you can do all sorts of crazy things, such as looking at the space of all tensors and then looking at tensors on the space of tensors and then create this huge tower of tensors. But that's besides the point. But it's something you can do. And at this point, we would like to be able to find the basis for this space. Also, so we can find out what the dimension of it is. That's where tensor products come into play. Any questions on these things? Okay, so T is in here. So suppose we have a tensor. Now, because this is a multilinear map, this is fully specified by its action on basis elements of both V and V star. Just because it's linear, so the usual thing is that if you're acting, so T is acting on, say the first thing is a covector, so it's acting something like this. then because it's linear, we can pull out the alpha I, and then we get this. So this is something we can always do. So in general, we can do this. We can write T as T acting on the basis of everything. I'm using here, just so we know what's happening. This is the basis of V, the ones with EI. And then epsilon J is the basis of V star, is the dual basis. Not just any basis, but the dual one. So we can, to explain why this is the same as this alpha I turns out to be the basis element EI acting on alpha J epsilon J. EI is a vector. We can think of it as acting on a covector by feeding itself to the covector. So this acts on this covector by just feeding itself to it, and feeding EI to epsilon J gives us a delta. So that's how we get alpha I out of this. So by putting this thing together for all possible inputs, we see that T is going to be T acting on the basis. So we get, say, epsilon 1, epsilon I 2, all the way to epsilon I R. Then we act on the basis for V. G 1, epsilon J S. And then, because the action on this vector is the same as acting with EI on the vector, then we get EI1 tensor EI2 tensor, so on, tensor EI R tensor epsilon J1 tensor all the way to epsilon J. So the reason why we get this is that if we do and look at this thing for all of the other arguments, we just multiply by EI acting on this times E, well, say EI1 acting on something, EI2 acting on something. They all multiply together, but that's what the tensor product does. It multiplies the action of the maps after they act. So if we remove the inputs, this is what you end up with. And these things here, we can give them a name. So usually we call them T, I1, I2, IR, J1 to JS. And these ones are the components or the vector in the basis. Which is often what you are told tensors are. Instead of talking about this multilinear thing, you just say there are things with a bunch of components that transform in a certain way. Now, transforming in a certain way just means that if I change basis, EI, EI1, EI2, and so on, they're going to transform using some matrix into another basis. But these must be the dual basis, so they transform in the inverse way. And then when you look at what will happen to these things, they will transform, the vector part transforms with the inverse, the covector part transforms with the thing itself, and you get the usual transformation laws for tensors. Okay, we're out of time. The only thing that's left about tensors is attach them on the manifold, but we'll just do that on Monday. Are there any questions? Okay, great, then I'll see you in 2 hours for the tutorial.